We're discussing the Russian invasion of Ukraine with your questions front and center on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Biden issued a fresh round of economic sanctions Thursday and told Americans the U.S. stands up to bullies, saying that sanctions will show the people of Russia what President Putin has brought on.
This is going to take time. It's not going to occur. He's going to say, oh, my God, these sanctions are coming. I'm going to stand down. He's going to test the resolve of the West to see if we stay together, and we will.
What do you want to know about Russia's invasion? Are you Ukrainian? What have you heard from your loved ones there? 800-642-1234. Ted Gerber is a professor of sociology, director of the Wisconsin-Russia Project for UW-Madison Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia. Ted, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Kyiv under bombardment, Russian troops on the outskirts of the capital. We hear, you know, Secretary of State Antony Blinken on CBS News last night saying this is the opening salvo of a massive invasion. How surprised are you?
Well, I mean, I'm more shocked than surprised. I think this was telegraphed for quite some time that
yes.
Putin was saying something like this. But still, it's just very shocking. It's hard to believe one's eyes, you know, seeing these attacks and witnessing the scale is also very surprising.
When you look at the scale, and as you say, you know, U.S. telegraphing much of Putin's intentions, sharing out this intelligence with the American people, you know, this has been seen like a bold information strategy, but hasn't stopped Putin. What do you make of this deterrence tactic and this information tactic?
That's right. I think the tactic did make sense. It was it was definitely novel because we don't usually hear government officials laying out the details of intelligence reports. It's been remarkably prescient. I think the Biden administration and American intelligence in general deserves a lot of credit for really nailing it in terms of what Putin was actually going to do. They really mapped out the plans. It did not deter Putin, clearly. I think it was a good strategy to try to deter him, but I think he really made up his mind, regardless of what kinds of publicity there was going to be for his plans, that he would attack. So it's, it did prep the world, I think, for what was going to happen. So it was not really a surprise, as you asked. But, the horror of seeing a defenseless country being attacked and bombed and missiles landing and so forth, it really is quite shocking for those of us in my generation who haven't witnessed this kind of attack in Europe in our whole lives.
Did this intelligence, one intelligence person said the U.S., you know, really giving out this information that it was countering the disinformation, the false narratives that would have come up from Russia. Is there anything to that?
I think there is. I think Russia, of course, Mr. Putin has made the argument that Ukraine is crawling with neo-Nazis, which is beyond absurd. He's made the case that the Ukrainian government has had a campaign against the populations of the Russian-controlled or separatist or Russian-backed separatist-controlled regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. Those are both false claims, and I think it did help for the Biden administration to make it clean that this is a long-term planned operation, and everything that Putin has used to justify this, including the historical fiction that Ukraine has never been a real country, that these are all just brazen lies and propaganda. And I think it really was helpful to understand that this was an operation that has been planned ahead for a long time. And so it's really advancing Mr. Putin's objectives, Mr. Putin's goals. It has nothing to do with intervening in any way to serve some other cause in Ukraine that would be noble. So I did think it had that impact, particularly because of the credibility of the Biden announcements, as we've seen, because things have played out. So it gives more credibility to the U.S. perspective that this was anticipated. And so from that perspective, I do think it was.
Ted Gerber with us, professor of sociology at UW-Madison, focusing on Russia, Ukraine, other former Soviet countries. You can join in with your questions. How should the U.S. or the U.N. respond to Russia's invasion of Ukraine? Would you support sending U.S. troops? Where do you see the U.S.? What are the next steps? 800-642-1234. Ted, we've seen in recent hours Ukrainian President Zelensky pleading for help from European leaders, saying if you do not strongly help Ukraine, then tomorrow war will knock on your doors. How long can Zelensky and his government hold out?
Well, I'm afraid, I mean, I'm not a military expert, but I'm afraid for not very long. The Russian force assembled is just really superior in terms of numbers, in terms of technology and material. The Ukrainians have fought bravely, but I do think it's probably a matter of days before, at least before Kiev is taken. And in terms of Zelensky's requests, you know, sad to say, I just don't think that's in the cards. I don't think Europe or NATO or the U.S. are going to send troops to fight the Russian forces directly. There is, of course, talk of arming an insurgency should that develop, should Russia decide to occupy the country. However, I think it's really too early to say whether or not, you know, what the ground is going to look like, you know, if and when Kiev does fall, if and when, as the Putin leadership has made clear as its intention, it's able to decapitate, so to speak, the Ukrainian government, install some kind of puppet leaders. So whether an insurgency actually develops and if it does, the extent to which it will receive support from the West is kind of a tricky thing to do. So I'm not sure that it's actually that feasible. However, it certainly it is probably the greatest extent to which the United States and its NATO allies will provide direct military support to the Ukrainian effort. I don't think there's anybody in the U.S. or European government circles who are seriously considering sending troops to actually do battle with Russian forces.
Let's bring on a caller, Scott, joining us from Northern Illinois. Scott, you have sanctions on your mind. Go ahead.
I think that the U.S. should have been a little bit more quickly about implementing these sanctions. You know, once we saw the buildup at the border, I think the Biden administration should have brought that, right up for discussion right away and started, you know, bringing out a stronger image against Russia. And the other side of it, too, is how, you know, 2 days ago, we just put a pause on all federal oil, you know, oil drilling that's been going on. We put a pause on all that, and we're just looking to align ourselves with, you know, foreign oil and foreign natural gas, especially Germany. They've closed down all our nuclear plants in the last 2 years, and I think we need to have a discussion about us being reliant upon ourselves.
Scott, thank you for this. Ted, we've talked about sanctions before. What do you see?
Well, actually, I tend to agree that the Biden administration might have done well to impose at least an initial round of sanctions before the invasion actually took place. Clearly, the strategy was to sort of hold out sanctions as a stick to respond to punish Russia with once the invasion did start. I can see the logic behind the strategy that that Scott, the caller, just suggested, that it might have made sense to try to at least show a little bit of what was in store. I mean, I think, you know, most likely the Putin administration, the Putin regime, anticipated what would transpire, what would happen, and built that into its calculations. So it's not altogether clear that it would have made much of a difference. However, I think more preparation of the sanctions for the sanctions could have been done. Indeed, energy independence has been a goal of the United States for a number of years. And from what it's almost at that goal. I mean, the U.S. does not receive too much of its energy from abroad, but still remains.
But Europe is a different story at, I think, 40%.
Right.
Here's what I really want to ask you. Why don't we throw down sanctions that directly compromise Putin? Why go after, like, uber wealthy oligarchs first?
Yes. Well, I don't really know why not. I mean, I really think they should. I think part of the reason is Putin, you know, a lot of his wealth is actually hidden in the accounts of his circle, his friends. And so in a way, by sanctioning the wealthier Russians, that's a way of trying to get at Putin. And secondly, I mean, I think Putin himself has so much wealth that were you to sanction him, it wouldn't affect him that much. The idea of sanctioning the wealthiest oligarchs is to put pressure on him to get them to want to get rid of Putin. And I think probably the sanctions hurt them more than they would hurt Putin directly himself personally. And so the logic here is that the only way to get Putin to change his course is to get his circle, his main supporters on which he relies, which first and foremost is the Russian elite, to get them to feel some pain and therefore maybe turn them against Putin.
UW-Madison sociologist Ted Gerber directs the UW Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia as we discuss the Russian invasion of Ukraine and what's on your mind. How should NATO allies respond to this invasion? Are you a veteran of America's past wars? What worries you about this escalation and Russia's military strength? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Ted Gerber here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the capital under bombardment, next steps for the West. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Biden unveiled harsher sanctions Thursday, told reporters at the White House.
The only thing that I'm convinced of is if we don't stop now, he'll be emboldened. If we don't move against him now with these significant sanctions, he will be emboldened.
UW-Madison sociologist Ted Gerber directs the Wisconsin Russia Project with us for about nine more minutes. Lauren is joining us from Burlington. Hi, Lauren. Go ahead.
Hi. I don't think sanctions will work. Number one, one of the things that irritates me about the last few presidents is that we announce our strategy, in advance. There's no surprises anymore. And I feel that, let's look at North Korea. North Korea has not, they're still functioning, and they've been under sanctions for forever. Announcing these sanctions, I believe Putin had time to move money. He had time to, put things in place. And they don't scare him. The guy is, the guy is a psychopath. And I really feel like we're back in 1939 when we watched Germany invade Poland and the world sat on its butt and didn't do a doggone thing about it.
Lauren, let's see what Ted has to say. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's that is certainly an argument that many make, that sanctions are ineffective. The type and form of sanctions really can vary a lot. And the type of sanctions that the U.S. is imposing on Russia are quite sweeping. They include not only sanctions against Russia's financial institutions that make it much harder for them to secure capital. They also include sanctions on exports of various important technologies that are vital to Russia's industry, defense industry, their oil and gas industry. So it is... There are too many historical cases where in the past where sanctions have really changed behavior, but there is one, and that is in Iran. So very recently, sanctions imposed on the Iran government forced them to the table to agree to the now defunct nuclear deal. So I appreciate the point. I do think the analogy with Hitler attacking Poland perhaps is relevant, but you also have to take into account that the other option, military action against Russia, threatens quickly to escalate into a world war, including the possibility of nuclear war. And I think because Ukraine is not a member of NATO and has not been, there's no treaty obligation to actually send troops to defend it. If Russia were to attack a NATO country, I think the response would be quite different and quite swift. And if anything, I do believe that this conflict has stiffened NATO's resolve and unity. And so if there was any doubt, there was discussions maybe if we're Russia to attack a country like Estonia, about which it's made a lot of noise in recent years, there were questions about whether NATO would respond. And now I think it's quite clear that NATO's resolve has been stiffened. It's been reunified after the Trump period, in which there was a lot of dissension, So I think...
And I just want to add there, Biden did say the U.S. will defend every inch of NATO territory with the full force of American power. And in recent recent hours, we've also learned that the Pentagon is sending 7,000 more troops to Europe, and specifically to Germany.
That's right. That's quite telling. I think if Mr. Putin had intended to increase the level of unity and resolve among within NATO and increase the presence of U.S. troops on the European continent, he has achieved those objectives.
Mm. Doug, now in Lansing, Iowa. Doug, hi.
Hello?
Hi. We can hear you. Go ahead. Yes.
Yes. I think the major sanctions are great, but, you know, I think they need to get down in the sanction categories that will hurt other parts of the economy and not the lower employed people. I think they should do a complete travel ban to Russia, no tourism, because I've been to Russia and been to St. Petersburg and stuff, and it's a major economy for Russia. No tourism, just like they did with Cuba, which I really didn't agree with, but no tourism, no spending of credit cards. If the EU and other countries said, we are not going to travel to Russia, you cannot spend money in Russia.
Seal it off from the world is what I'm hearing, Doug.
Yes, but yes.
Ted Gerber.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. In fact, I think Russia probably, you know, its tourism industry has really declined anyway in recent years because of the COVID pandemic. I don't know that that would in and of itself have much independent impact. I think what others have suggested is that there should be harsher sanctions against the Russian elite, in particular in London. There are a lot of, you know, wealthy Russians running around living great lavish lifestyles. You know, the children are in expensive schools there, and there's been talk of kicking them out and making it harder, you know, for the Russian elite to be able to travel, because those types of sanctions would directly bite the elite, which is, again, I think the appropriate target of these sanctions. Although, of course, the Russian public is going to feel a lot of pain from this. Prices are going to go up there. It's going to be harder for them to get goods. The value of their wages are going to decline. But I do think cutting Russia off from SWIFT is another step that has not yet been taken. That's the system which banks communicate to each other that will make it a lot harder for capital flows to occur involving Russian banks, and the Europeans are reluctant to do that. So I think it could still be more, we could still be seeing more sanctions in the days and weeks to come as the conflict progresses. And those two items that I just mentioned are probably in the cards, I think. I think they're still continuing to roll them out, and we'll see more.
Let's go to Adam now in Madison. Hi, Adam.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
I just wanted to make the point that it's kind of disappointing when you watch the news and listen to the news on the radio. Like, people are constantly talking about the cost for Americans is going to be oil, like oil prices at the pump. And it's disappointing that we see the biggest escalation of war in Europe since World War II. And the first thing Americans want to talk about is the gas prices. Like, this is democracy we're talking about. Another point would be just that we have treason in plain sight. The Republicans took money from the NRA, who laundered money from Russia, and nobody talks about that anymore.
Adam, thank you. Ted Gerber.
Well, I certainly agree with the first point. I think this is not, you know, some kind of isolated minor conflict somewhere in the world. This is war in Europe. This is one country attacking a essentially defenseless and helpless country that did it no wrong, sending in tanks, bombing, missile attacks. And we can't let that kind of behavior become the norm. So I certainly agree that a lot of the discussions in the U.S. that are focused on the potential pain that Americans will experience, consider in relative terms what kind of pain the Ukrainians are experiencing. And even our European allies will experience more pain as a result of these sanctions. Americans, in my view, need to realize that a lot is at stake here. It's not just some minor conflict, and some of the American politicians, I think, have certainly played into the hands of that argument. We know that Trump, for example, has called Putin a genius for his declaration of independence for the two breakaway republics, and that kind of thinking really is not helpful. I think one of the previous caller's analogies with Hitler attacking Poland and initiating the Second World War, that is very apropos, it's very relevant here. And Americans need to think about, you know, the cost of freedom. As others have said, freedom is not free, and we have to be willing to make some sacrifices. Moreover, gas prices are going to go up anyway, and so it's not really clear how much this, you know, the American sanctions as such are going to affect gas prices. They will some, but generally, even without that, you know, the markets are going to be disrupted by a war. And so I think the discussion in the United States should focus more on what is at stake and less on the costs to American pocketbooks. Although, you know, of course, as the president alluded to in his speech yesterday, he is aware of that. And the United States maybe will be taking some steps to alleviate some of the pain that Americans feel.
Ted, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Ted Gerber, professor of sociology, director of the Wisconsin Russia Project for UW-Madison Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia. The Ideas Network is working to schedule more conversations about Russia's attacks on Ukraine, including members of Wisconsin's congressional delegation. For more coverage, visit WPR.org. News is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Carl Christensen brings us a story about Wisconsin comedian and now best-selling author Charlie Behrens.
Comedian and host of the Manitowoc Minute, Charlie Behrens, is at it again, this time with his book landing on the New York Times bestsellers list. Beta host Doug Gordon recently caught up with Charlie, where he asks him about the difference between the Manitowoc Minute guy and the real Charlie Behrens.
Well, the Manitowoc Minute version is basically just an exaggerated version of who I am. And it, you know, is based off my time in local news where people would say I did things wrong. I said things wrong. I had an accent. Bubbler is not a word you can say in Texas, and it means the same thing in Wisconsin. And so the Manitowoc Minute version is a parody of the newsman that I was, where I doubled down on all the things people said I was doing wrong. Whereas, you know, in this book, I'm kind of coming to it more from who I really am. There's a lot of stories there growing up and everything, but the heart of both the Manitowoc Minute character and kind of who I am is the same. It's that same sort of Midwest mentality, that kind of be nice first, ask questions later.
How can I help you?
I'll just get whatever's easiest for you guys. It'll be good.
You just look at the menu and pick whatever you want.
No, I insist, whatever's easiest.
Well, spicy food is pretty quick and easy. Can you do spicy?
Yeah, I can do spicy. Yeah.
Are you sure? Cajun spicy. Let's down south Mississippi.
I've been down south. I've been to Cudahy. So.
Can you identify a turning point along your journey where you realized that your Manitowoc Minute was going to become your very own media empire?
Oh, no. I was doing stand-up because I wasn't thrilled with my job at the time. And I did this character, which would become the Manitowoc Minute character, in the comedy clubs. And I remember this one show in particular at the Comedy Store. And I said, is anybody from the Midwest? And then you see in this Los Angeles comedy club, like a quarter of the room, maybe more, had their hands up. And so, you know, and that bit always did well. No matter how much my other stand-up bombed, that would always help me recover. So I was like, oh, there's something here. So I made this video, the first video, the Manitowoc Minute.
Okay, welcome to the Manitowoc Minute. This week's episode sponsored by Bobberdown Bait Shop up there in Plover. Plover, of course, is right off 39 right before you get to Stevens Point. If you get to Stevens Point, point her back the other way. Let's get these headlines done real quick once.
And it was, I named it after a fella in that club who was talking to me. He's from Manitowoc. So I didn't think I'd do a second one. And then that first one took off. You know, I think it got 500,000 views.
Why does Midwest life resonate with the rest of the country?
Well, you know, I think that it's one of those areas. A lot of people from other parts of the country view it as sort of the flyover states. And I think it's been largely ignored in pop culture, or it's been viewed as just kind of bland or somewhere in the middle, you know? But I think as we've kind of explored it, and there are a lot of comedians now sort of exploring the Midwest, we see these staples of our culture that you don't often think of. once you shine a little flashlight on them, they're like, oh, that's pretty cool.
Since our show Beta airs on Wisconsin Public Radio, we always have to be careful about the kind of language that we use. Could you give us some Midwest alternatives to cuss words that we could use for when the proverbial guano hits the fan?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you can say anything. Cripes is a staple, you know, and my grandpa Bob taught me that, you know, he didn't want to take the Lord's name in vain, so he would always say, cripes almighty.
Seasoned rice. Criminy. Fudge. So you get a 1/4-inch bit and, son of a bitch. I mean, jeepers cripes. Get grandpa a beer, will ya?
Charlie Barron's book is called The Midwest Survival Guide, How We Talk, Love, Work, Drink, and Eat Everything with Ranch. You can hear the full conversation on WPR's Beta. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
And now to the shortage of healthcare workers in rural communities. It's an issue that the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative is laser focused on, as its network is operated by 45 acute care rural hospitals. Do you work at a hospital that is short staffed? What is that like? Have you had to limit your bed capacity or work back-to-back shifts due to staffing constraints? Share what you're experiencing in your clinic, on your floor, 800-642-1234. Tim Size is founding executive director of the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative. Tim, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me again, Kate.
Well, what are your conversations like with your network rural hospitals right now about staffing levels?
Well, they're thankfully a lot... It's still a significant issue, but it's a lot less stressful than it was 2 and 3 weeks ago, as hospitalization rates have really started to come down from the pandemic. We do have shortages. We will continue to have shortages in the kind of pandemic-driven shortages are some specific areas like lab techs, CNAs, respiratory therapists. Our concern, though, is that we need to be thinking much longer term, and in particular, having at top of mind the recent report that came out showing that we're going to be about 16,000 nurses short pretty soon, by 2035. And given the amount of time it takes to ramp up programs and recruit kids and get teachers, that's like around the corner. What that means is, let's say it's the projections are twice as pessimistic as they should be, and it's only 8,000. That still dwarfs the shortages of nurses that we've experienced during the pandemic. And I think regardless of politics about masking and vaccination, I think we've all seen what happens to our access to healthcare when we're short thousands of nurses.
This is a chronic problem. These shortages have been with us for a while. My guess is they were worsened by the pandemic. What has been done over the years to address this problem?
We have gradually increased the number of graduates in our schools of nursing and other healthcare professions through our universities, college, the vocational technical system. But we are talking about something very different now, and I have to be very clear about it. And it's largely not driven by the pandemic. Yes, we did get some early retirements from the pandemic. People got burned out, understandably so, and have just decided to do something else with their lives. The real big issue is the silver tsunami, the aging and retirement of baby boomers. And unlike other parts of our economy and our state, when people retire and leave the being a nurse or doctor or lab tech, what have you, unfortunately, around the same time, they start themselves to be more active consumers, users, patients of healthcare. And so it's kind of a double whammy. And we have not adequately prepared for the retirement of the baby boomers. And so that's largely what is driving this projection of 16,000 nurses short.
Here's something I really also want to ask you, and I get the demographics piece, the aging Wisconsin piece, but in the hospitals themselves, do the care models of these hospitals rely too heavily on nurses? Are nurses being asked to do too much?
Well, they certainly were during the pandemic because there weren't enough nurses. Nursing is central to healthcare and particularly hospital care. There are adjustments that can be made. More technology may save some needs for some nurses, but the Wisconsin Council on Medical Education and Workforce, which did this study, their projections are very consistent with the Wisconsin Center for Nursing and the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. And they kind of take a conservative approach, and I don't mean politically, but just in terms of whenever they had a chance to estimate something, they were more cautious.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the best number we have. Yeah, we could all of a sudden have every nurse in every other state in America come to Wisconsin, or we could suddenly discover 5 pills that make hospitalizations not necessary. But I think that's not a prudent approach. The prudent approach is we have to recognize we only produce about 3,200 nurses a year. And so to make up this gap of 16,000, that's an increase of 50% over the next 10 years. That's a very, very heavy lift. And the longer we delay addressing this issue, the more difficult it is going to be to close the gap.
Well, speaking of nurses coming to Wisconsin, what about travel nurses and how they have been used in the shortage?
With some controversy.
You think?
That's been a stressor for all of our hospitals.
Yes.
And the reality is when you have patients waiting to be in the emergency room to be admitted to a bed and you don't have enough people, you have to make certain choices. I'm looking forward to day travelers become something in the background in true emergencies. But it's obviously, it was something that helped, but it's also something that created a great deal of discontent.
Certainly the headlines, the news reports on travel nurses earning, you know, $90 an hour, $10,000 a week on a 36-hour work week. Axios reporting in recent days that travel nursing staffing firms are hitting their biggest revenue highs in the fourth quarter, really cashing out as hospitals pay top dollar. What do those reports mean to you in terms of your rural hospitals?
I think it's totally been driven by the pandemic. And we were in existential crisis 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. We had no choice but to use travelers. I think as our numbers come back to normal, our use of travelers will be much more episodic as it has been historically. And you're right, the firms that had the infrastructure to provide travelers had made out like bandits during this time. But I think it's a mistake to say we've seen the future. I think what we saw was a partially helpful, partially dysfunctional response to an unprecedented shortage and emergency in our healthcare system. In fact, it's a good point in terms of if we don't increase substantially the number of nurses that are being trained and graduated in our state, we will get right back to this dependency on travelers, which is very much Peter robbing Paul between hospitals among states. So if we don't want to go back to this period of time of dependency on nurses that nobody can afford at that level, we really have to ramp up our education here. I mean, the numbers are clear. We have to face this threat. And the longer we look the other way, the harder the fix will be.
Tim Size founded the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative decades ago. Do you work in healthcare at a hospital or clinic? Have you considered leaving the field, retiring? Where might you go? What do you make of the vacant jobs? Or is your healthcare team back to full staff? Still time to talk about what you see. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Tim Size here on the Ideas Network. The Omicron surge battered hospital staffing, especially among nurses, pushed hospitals to rely more heavily on travel nurses, as we've been talking about, discussing the implications for rural hospitals here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the new American College of Healthcare Executives annual survey, staffing and personnel shortages are the number one concern hospital CEOs faced in 2021, and marked the first time in 17 years that staffing fears overtook financial challenges as a top concern. So what should Wisconsin do to boost its number of healthcare workers? Should travel nurse salaries be capped? 800-642-1234. Tim Size leads the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative, a network of 45 rural hospitals, with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in Lori now in Milwaukee. Lori, you were a nurse for 40 years.
Yes.
What would you like to bring up?
Well, what I'd like to bring up with nurses being short-staffed has been a problem for the 40 years I was a nurse. Short-staffing, people think nurses get paid a lot, but when you take any technical vocation that's dominated by men, plumbers, electricians, painters, nurses' wages pale in comparison. I never really took a break when I worked on the floor in a hospital. I didn't have time to do everything you're supposed to do, required you to be basically working every minute. And with the pandemic, I actually retired December before the pandemic hit. Mm-hmm. It was planned. I was going to go back to help. I felt it a moral imperative, but when I was told I wouldn't even be offered a mask that would be protective, I'm 67. I thought, well, I want to help, but I don't want to give my life. But nurses have never stood up for themselves and their patients and demanded adequate staffing. And so this, you know, and then there, and then what I found here, I'll ramble, ironic is that traveler nurses have always gotten paid excessive wages. It bothered me as a floor nurse, but they're talking about capping nurses' wages in a crisis as if nurses are price gouging, and yet it's always been that way. You know, I mean, it's just ironic.
Lori, Lori, you bring up so many points here. Tim, what are your thoughts? What's coming up?
Well, I guess what I've been trying to say, we have to substantially increase the number of nurses we are educating. I would say there's a lot of interest in nursing. Most of our schools have waiting lists. The problem is our faculty are aging out and the schools cannot compete with the salaries of comparably trained nurses who are doing clinical practice. So we currently are not really replacing the faculty we have. At the time, we need to significantly grow it. And so if you think of it, it's like an hourglass, and the choke point isn't hospitals, it's not dollars they pay, it's the lack of faculty to train the next generation of nurses.
But, you know, I mean, going back to Lori's points, never taking a break, working every minute on the floor, not being able to, you know, get done what you're supposed to get done in that time. And Lori's saying, look, nurses haven't stood up for fair wages. What would you say on that point?
I don't know Lori. I don't know her experience. It is an experience that some nurses have had in some hospitals. I don't think it's typical of the hospitals we work with. Nurses I know, in fact, are pretty assertive. Maybe I just know a different group of nurses. In terms of the financial ability of our hospitals to pay more, my biggest concern for our hospitals is they're not like sitting on cash, and I'm speaking for rural hospitals. I can't speak for all hospitals, but about 40% of America's hospitals are either at immediate or high risk of closure. So I would agree, if we as rural hospitals can only pay that which society insures and government gives us in cash to pay people. And it's a balancing act that we do as good as we can.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you see in your rural hospitals nurses advancing to be executives? Do you have any former nurses who are now CEOs of rural hospitals?
Absolutely, and they're on my board of directors.
Do they offer a different glimpse, do you think, than what we're seeing elsewhere? Do they prioritize nurses?
I think all the administrators I know, whether they started their career as a nurse or not, prioritize nurses. And the caller from Milwaukee may disagree with me, but my experience is different than hers. They're the majority of the workforce, certainly of the professional workforce in our hospitals. You don't survive long as an administrator without listening very deeply to what those nurses think about healthcare.
Have nurses had adequate representation? We've seen unions, nursing unions in other states, very much have a prominent role in protecting wages, in advocating for nurses. What is the role of unions? Of course, unionizing here in Wisconsin, not the case.
With maybe one exception, you need a different guest to address that. It's very much more a larger hospital urban issue. Hmm. When you're in your smaller communities and smaller hospitals, they tend to work things out. And you don't tend to see unions in smaller rural hospitals. So it's just something I'm not very conversant about.
What about hiring international nurses, allocating immigrant visas expressly for nurses? I think this is the Healthcare Workforce Resilience Act out of Congress, prioritizing healthcare workers from other countries.
Rural Wisconsin has always been dependent on flow of trained professionals from other countries, particularly in medicine, somewhat less so in nursing. But again, it's a complex issue. That's part of a solution. I'm much more comfortable with us growing our own as long as we have many Wisconsin men and women trying to get in schools of nursing. So I think it's the responsible thing for us to increase the ability to train those people.
But what is constricting class sizes in these colleges and universities? I mean, I've heard that you can only have so many student nurses in the clinical setting at once. It's hard to expand these class sizes. You mentioned nursing instructors can earn more in private practice. So what are those barriers of just growing class sizes?
Well, there's national accreditation that dictates those sorts of things. And that's why my focus has been on how do we facilitate our schools to be able to compete for highly trained nurses to come into the schools and teach the next generation.
Mm. Tim, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Tim Tsai is founding executive director of the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.